So, some things to say about Dylan Fitzwater's text, Autonomy is in Our Hearts, a text which I really love. It's given maybe the most detailed view into the concrete processes of organization that the Zapatistas have carried out. In case you haven't looked at it, Fitzwater took part in a couple of educational projects that were staged by the Zapatistas. So he studied the Tzotzil language, and the text is built around some key Tzotzil terms. This is one of the language groups, tribal groups within the Zapatista world. And he studied Spanish there, and then he was put through this educational series of, I think, four stages. Which basically consisted, it's like a manual for how Zapatista organizing is to be done, but really what it consists in is a bunch of firsthand accounts by different people who have been through and have been involved with Zapatista organizing. So instead of laying out rules and a constitution about like what needs to be done, there are examples given, and the idea is that these examples, and this is the purpose that I would think that our reading and our discussion ought to have, if it's going to impact you, these examples are offered as seeds, which will grow differently in different contexts depending on those contexts. So it's not exactly here's how you got to organize, but here are some principles, here are some basic patterns, here are some starting points that you could deploy in your territory, and let's see where those would go. So I thought maybe the best way to start would be to go through four or five of the key terms that Fitzwater talks about in the sections that I gave you, which he feels they're Tzotzil terms, but he feels that these terms encompass much of the practicality of what Zapatista organizing is and has been. So even to say that means that there is a contemporary set of practices, and one of the main things that he wants to show is that those practices and the empirical forms of governance which exist in Chiapas and increasingly across Mexico and even beyond, like La Sexta, the sixth declaration from the Lacandon jungle, called on communities even outside of Mexico to organize themselves in this way. Those forms are experimental and developing and only exist in relationship with the empirical, concrete, material circumstances where they unfold. So they're not just traditional or indigenous. And yet, on the other hand, the purpose of looking at the Tzotzil terms instead of just translating everything is to say that there is something indigenous about these seeds. These are concepts that exist within the Tzotzil language and the Tzotzil culture, which have a value and which still have the power to grow even in new soils, even in new industrialized soils, for example. So let me go through these terms. Ishbayal Tamuk, and I have no idea if my pronunciation is good or bad, carrying one another to greatness. A process of organizing, and I think this term is used especially in order to talk about group formation and the formation of group consciousness and group solidarity. This seems to be the term that is used throughout Fitzwater. Ishbayal Tamuk is the process of gathering individuals into a group and ultimately the process by which groups are pulled into larger collectivities. Pulling into a group heart would be the technical language, Awan, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the character of this pulling people into community, pulling people who were not in a community into a real community where they feel and understand a commonality, this is all about becoming common, is based on principles. And the principles here are mutual respect, mutual recognition, and reciprocity. So those things I think are worth reflecting on because they seem to reiterate some of the fundamentals of indigenous thought in general, if there is an in general. But of course, they also point back at Western figures like Hegel or Angela Davis, who I think in a lot of ways is Hegelian or was Hegelian, which says that in order for us to be free, it is not sufficient for us to be by ourselves or to be, you know, unhindered in certain respects. Real human freedom has to do with recognition. We require mutual recognition to be fully human. I have to see you, and you have to see me seeing you be free. The way that Angela Davis would read this, we have to see in one another the transcendence of what it is that we see. We have to see each other as freedoms. And this sort of group formation is therefore not a pulling together of people into a hierarchy where they are instrumentalized, or into a false identity where they all just recognize themselves in the flag or in Hitler, right? Like general nationalism, or, you know, other forms of, there are other forms of group building. If you want to get a good look at that, go check out like Freud's group psychology. Like a whole lot of later stuff is built out of that text. But this is a different form of group building, certainly one not talked about by Freud, who was very pessimistic, which says that we can pull ourselves together in such a fashion that we experience real commonality, that we come to share a heart, that we come to share a basic understanding of our situation, of ourselves, of our belonging in a situation, of our interests in that situation, of our shared desires, of our shared affects. So Ishbael Tamuk is a general term for coming into community, but it's also a concrete practice that happens by a particular form of organizing. Owan, and then derivatives of that, what are they? Kuantik and Kuantik are all referring to group heart, meaning the existence of a real community that really experiences commonality and ultimately acts in common, sharing a group heart. Paskop means struggle, but more specifically it means passing from words, and especially the kinds of words that can become at by getting together in a group where we behave according to the principles of mutual respect, mutual recognition, and where we really talk about our real situation, where, you know, as Malcolm X says, we don't bullshit. Well, he doesn't say that. That's my way of saying what he says. You know, where we tell it straight, he might say. And passing from that talk into action. Paskop is the making material, the bringing into actuality of the word. So in Paulo Freire, for example, this is very similar, I think, to integrity, or the general term that we've used throughout this course, praxis, the conjoining, the mutual reciprocity between thought and action. That's Paskop. And then Chulel. Chulel is potentiality. And potentiality is assembled as a group is assembled. And potentiality is, of course, the capacity for doing things, the capacity to transform and to become something other. That's potentiality. But the important thing here, which should be familiar from, say, like Vine Deloria, is that in this thinking, the potentiality, which is like a real force in the world and something that you really can feel, this is like Tikkun too, something that you really can feel. In Tikkun, it would be called intensity. To feel intensity is to be in touch with potentiality. But potentiality doesn't just come from individuals. It comes from relationships. Relationships are the bedrock, are the foundation of potentiality. So insofar as I am around certain things, around certain people, certain things become possible. And those possibilities are real forces in the world. They are the relationships, as we put it before, want to be completed. They have a, like I tried to say last time we met, they have a sort of vector. They point in a certain direction. Certain things are possible between certain people or for certain people at a certain place. And you can feel that potentiality. And the question is, will that potentiality be followed out or will it be betrayed? Will it be shut down? And of course, I suppose there are certain potentialities that we don't want to develop. But pulling people together into a group and constructing a collective heart, an Owan, is also assembling the material possibility for greater activity and self and group transformation. There is no such thing as a collective heart that is not composed of a system of potentialities. And the heart intensifies and the commonality becomes greater as those potentialities are witnessed and they are respected, that we recognize the potentialities and we allow ourselves to commit to them. We give ourselves over to the development of the intensity. And then the last term, lekil kuchlajl. I'm sure I'm mutilating that. I take to be a term designating a goal. And the goal here of Zapatista organizing is autonomy and dignified life. That's where we're heading. So, okay, I think we can look at this model as it's a philosophical model, and I'll just read back over it again. Like, you know, what is the picture of what we should do if we wish to establish autonomy and dignified life, which sounds a lot like freedom to me. What would we have to do in order to establish freedom and self-determination at the economic and the political and the cultural and the educational levels, in order to establish reciprocity, in order to establish respectful life, where we see one another even in our differences, and instead of attempting to destroy those differences, we recognize that across difference there exists potentials which we can nurture and all that. How should we do it? We can answer that question in a philosophical way, which is, these terms are philosophical concepts, right? They're at a certain level of abstraction. But then we can also put this into concrete terms, and we can put the goals into concrete terms and the means into concrete terms. So this is what I want to step through quickly. So remember, the model is a seed, right? It's a seed, meaning like it has to be put in a soil. It has to receive some nutrients. It has to receive some light. It has to receive some water. And this soil and these nutrients and this light and this water are going to be different from the seed, right? Like, and a seed that grows in one context will grow in one way. And if it grows in another soil and light, it'll grow in another way, right? So these models are not rigid rules that need to be followed. They are... They're seeds. So how does this model look on the whole? Okay, the process passes from, like, let us begin with a pretty good assumption that we all are atomized beings living in the society of the spectacle, under empire, in the age of neoliberalism. We are separated from one another. We are plugged into our iPhones, and we are TV watchers eating Cheetos. And we do not look autonomous or dignified. And we don't really know what to say when people ask us who is our community. And we take community to be an abstract term because we haven't experienced it as a concrete and intensive term. How do we get out of that situation? So the first answer is, okay, you need to go, you need to establish a one. Right? Like, what does this mean? Establish a group heart. So we have to pull people together. And so this is a practical thing too, right? Like, you have to make groupings of people. You have to pull people together and actually be together, but not just do your hobbies and not just reinforce your pre-existing tendencies, not just amuse one another, but start to feel out and understand the situation in which you find yourself. Pursue the commonalities that you really have. Look for the commonalities in your situations, the commonalities of your exploitation, the commonalities of your desires, the way that your desires conflict with your circumstance. And then you can start to think about your common interests. And once you identify your common interests, you can start to identify means by which those interests might be advanced. And now I'm saying the same thing I said around Malcolm X, right? Because I think it's the same sort of practice of organizing that's being talked about here. But there's a metaphysical dimension to this, which is that what we're doing when we pull ourselves together in this way and we speak honestly about our real situations, about our real desires, about our real fears, is that we start to feel these commonalities. And they're not just like the commonalities of the group. They are very specific potentialities that exist within the grouping, right? So first we need to build groups, and these groups need to develop their own integrity, to develop their power. And then across a longer period of time, this is the distinction between quantique and quantique. Quantique refers to smaller collective bodies, but these smaller collective bodies can be pulled into a larger Owan group heart, in which case then we can talk about Kwantik, right? And the process is the same. They get gathered together. They start to feel out their potentialities. And what does this mean at like a practical level? We're talking about assembling people and having them talk honestly. But then also, this is a process of pascal, right? So we're getting in groups and we're understanding our commonalities and we're understanding our interests and so on, but we're also starting to recognize that there is something that we want. And the thing that we want on this model, the thing that we are growing even through this process, we can feel it all along, but maybe growing more intensely, is mutual respect and mutual recognition. We want to draw one another into greatness, right? So pascal refers to the recognition of our need for mutual respect and autonomy and dignified life, and the passage of that recognition into some kind of activity that we have selected. Okay, so this is their philosophy, if you like, or this is one way of looking at the Zapatista philosophy from the Tzotzil perspective, and he mentions also the Tetzal language is similar to the Tzotzil in these respects. If you wanted to look at this just as a practice of organizing, and you wanted to think about how did the Zapatistas build a Zapatista world where none existed before. Now, it's not that there was nothing, right? There were shared languages and there were shared cultures, but there was also a whole lot of separation, a whole lot of drinking, a lot of abuse of women. And then nobody lived in the mountains where the Zapatistas organized. So the communities that they were building in some ways were built from scratch. So how did these organizers do what they did? They walked miles and days through the jungle and through the mountains from one village to the next, and they went one person at a time in each village, and they talked to that person, and they tried to wake up a kind of critical consciousness and a consciousness of sadness to reawaken feelings that were otherwise being suppressed by drink, for example, to explain where these feelings come from and how they're real and how they're justified, explain exploitation, explain the relationship between these people in Chiapas and the larger scale Mexican structure and the global structure, and then to draw them into a group where they can share this experience, where they can start to see that this situation of theirs, this sadness of theirs, is not an individual thing. It is not an individual deficiency that you ought to be ashamed of. Like, why are you such a grumpy and depressive person? I mean, in our world, we are encouraged to individualize all of these things, right? Oh, you feel bad? Well, you're probably, you know, serotonin deficient, you might be told, right? Like, we are taught to treat our feelings as if they were individual phenomena, but they're not. They're circumstantial and relational phenomena. So you pull together more and more people to start understanding the commonality of their situation, of their feeling, of their desire. But then also, as you pull in more and more people, and these are people who are being maybe gathered up from public events, so you throw parties if you can, but you find the people who might be fighters, maybe the ones who are less drunk would be more useful, and you pull them into, what do they call them, secret gatherings, outside the village, and you try and build more and more the base in the village until finally, perhaps, you get to the point where the entire village is thinking along these lines, and then the village becomes a gathering place for other people. Like, the whole practice has to do with gathering people together and getting them to talk about their real circumstance. And then out of a network built painstakingly across a decade in this way, you get now quasi-autonomous villages. And these villages, these groupings, are now capable of generating principles for themselves. So the revolutionary laws by which EZLN is the hierarchical, top-down, mostly, military aspect of Zapatista culture, it operates according to laws that are generated on a democratic basis by these autonomous communities. So the revolutionary laws are generated by the communities themselves and then deployed by their armed wing. And then circumstances call for these groupings, either on a small scale or a larger scale, to deal with new problems. So the original sort of Marxist-Leninist organizers who came into the Chiapas territory had thought that when women joined their group, this would fix the inequalities that existed previously between men and women, but it didn't. So then the communities talk this problem through, and they develop the Revolutionary Law of Women, which works to correct inequalities between men and women very specifically on a concrete basis by changing or eradicating the economic dependency of women upon men, but also by nurturing groupings of women where they can become empowered business enterprises, cooperative enterprises. Or they come up with rules like, okay, in Zapatista communities, there is no alcohol allowed, right? This is not like a model that we would all have to follow, but if we are in communities where alcohol stands in the way of dealing with the situation, then maybe it is one that we would have to come up with. Okay, so what is this driving towards? It's driving at autonomy and a dignified life at a political system where a whole bunch of different autonomous groups each define what democracy is for them. They work out their own manifestation of democracy, but then they're capable of developing and sustaining for periods, or you know, these might go away and then reappear, larger scale collectivities by agreeing on principles. It's not rules exactly, it's principles, things that you could implement differently in different circumstances. What are those kinds of principles? And I think they're the kind of principles that we can deploy in our classes. Mutual respect and recognition. The idea that we have to come, whatever we're going to do, we're going to do by coming to an agreement through an assembly. Or more specific principles, like the beautiful one, I think, the idea of governing by obeying. It may be that we need to establish executive committees, you know, a smaller group of people to orchestrate our meetings, a smaller group of people to implement our decisions. These are committees, right? But those committees have to follow certain rules, and specifically, they have to be recallable at all times. They cannot have authority over anybody else. And what they have to do is just obey the edicts that are given them by the assemblies. So governing by obeying, and there are more, but these are principles, right? The principles originate from the democratic collective. They are deployed in the action of that collective, broken into committees. And then across time, the community is shaping itself. It is changing its form across time on the basis of autonomous decision-making, right? Okay, so how did this all happen? How does it need to happen? Well, in the Zapatista case, it begins with the military takeover of land. You need space. And I think this is true for a bunch of these contemporary movements that I wanted to draw your attention to, is that they have to do with space. They require space. Politicization, which means causing people to get involved in talking about their situation and what to do about it. Just talking, but this requires getting together, and getting together requires having a place to get together. These are place-based practices. Real meetings have to happen, which means that space has to be made. But of course, if you're looking for political and economic autonomy, as we all ought to be, this also requires that there be space for the raising of food. So in this case, it begins with the takeover of many, what is it, like 500,000 acres of ranchers' land. So like there's an insurgency on the part of the lowest classes, the Indian people who had been working for richer ranchers, take over that land by force of arms, and then they hold it. This is the EZLN. Doesn't hurt to have a self-defense organization. Doesn't hurt to know how to take and defend space. So we need to be militant in this respect, or at least they did. I think maybe this is an open question for us. Like, what spaces are there? How do we take them? How do we gather people? Not all spaces are the same. Spaces will demand different things of us, and we will behave in different ways in different spaces. What are the spaces that we need, and how do we liberate them? These are key questions. And then across time, in the Zapatista case, the very form of governmentality, the very form of self-government becomes more complex. And it becomes more complex for a couple of reasons. So first you have autonomous groups, and then you have autonomous villages. And then you get autonomous municipalities, which encompass a number of villages. And then eventually you get the caracoles, the good government centers, which exist basically to collaborate between, to coordinate between municipalities and between villages. So the very fact of there being a large-scale organization requires specialized organs. But what these organs are, what groupings, which again, they all point back to places and assemblies, right? And this is true in Rojava too, that there are all these complicated interlacing forms of economic and political and educational self-organization, but they're almost entirely reducible to groupings of people engaged in certain activities. And it's true in Rojava too that across time the structure becomes more complex, not unworkable, but more complex. So there are some organs, some patterns of development, self-organizational development that respond to the very complexity of the system itself. And then there are some organs and practices and changes that respond to the circumstance in which this political, economic, autonomous community is existing. And in the case of the Zapatistas, the primary circumstantial consideration is the Mexican military's counterinsurgency against the Zapatistas. So the constant military threats, the real use of violence, and especially the development of proxy anti-Zapatista indigenous groups within their own territory. Right? These are tactics of the Mexican military in order to shut down this process because they don't want autonomous self-government. They don't want it. The nation state is opposed to that, and the nation state, I would argue, you know, serves capitalist interests. The capitalists certainly do not want there to be self-government in this territory where there is oil and uranium. Self-government means non-access to those things. So very powerful interests are arranged opposite the Zapatistas, and the form of Zapatista self-government, therefore, has to allow for and respond to these real threats and these real circumstantial factors.